welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we just ended the... Well, I tried to end. We only had like a minute left after I was done. And Paul came back to kind of say, maybe I said it all. But actually, Paul, if I had a little bit more latitude, this is what I would conclude. That when it comes really down to it, it's not really a black or white issue. And welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
And so it's not really a black or white issue. And I don't mean racially. I mean, you know, it's not either this or that. It's not a binary issue. Nor is it an issue, you know, because we've already identified that there's two groups that have made it a binary issue, the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. But there's another group out there that because of what they've done, that's actually spurred this whole movement of these different organizations forming to getting people to abandon the Constitution. Because most people see that those aren't, they're not providing it. They're actually buying into that the whole Constitution is the problem. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of why I started off yesterday's show or somehow talking about how we all, you know, allow ourselves to be tempted. We all allow ourselves to be misled. Because in some ways we have these biases, these filters. And a lot of the problems come from our education. A lot of the problems come from a lack of religious and spiritual guidance and what have you. But the divisive nature that both the conventionites, the anti-conventionites, and these abandoning the Constitution organizations are doing is destroying us.
Mm-hmm.
The adage, united we stand, divided we fall, and when it comes to, and this is why I am so anti-conservative movement, because it is way too ambiguous. I am a part of the constitutional movement in uniting and taking a full stand of enforcing the Constitution and demanding full compliance to the Constitution of our public servants. I mean, it's a mouthful, folks, but still, this is the only direction forward. We have all the tools necessary. We need to use the Constitution as our weapon, and we need to stop listening to the conventionites and the anti-conventionites and all of these other people saying, no, we need to chase, you know, this, we need to chase that. And they're misleading us, and they're deliberately doing this. Whether they know it or not, they've allowed themselves, because technically, folks, when we're misguided, we allow ourselves to be misguided. At every point of time we receive information, we have an opportunity to go and challenge that and actually, you know, take it to the Lord. But once you've taken it to the Lord, you still need to go and verify. You need to do the due diligence, which is why one of the key things Paul said yesterday is that there's no evidence. There's nobody that's been able to prove these wild assertions of those who are abandoning the Constitution, those who are creating the Jural assemblies and these other assemblies and the nationalists and so forth, the Anna von Ritz. I mean, every time I read the papers that come from Anna von Ritz or what have you, I go, this woman is clueless. She does not know the Constitution. She actually believes that the Constitution is an illegitimate document. So anyway, because the way she writes and the way she talks, and she basically confers us back to the Declaration of Independence, which I'm telling you, that is literally going backwards, because what she's doing and what the Jural assemblies, they're all leading us backwards to a monarchical form of government.
And they even often refer to British law.
Yes.
And I was having a conversation with somebody who was referring to the Sesekevi Act of 1666.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I reminded him that in the Declaration of Independence, in the last, just about the last paragraph, where in one sentence we go from colonies to free and independent states.
Right.
Breaking all ties to Britain. All right. And so that included ancient British acts. We're starting anew.
Right.
We were starting anew. And after the conversation, he said, okay, I'll give you that, but... Okay, and then he went on to quote the, and then he went on to tell me about the, what is it? The Magna Carta.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, and so all British acts. Well, what happens is when we finally came up with the Constitution, it didn't come right after the Revolution, but when it did,
right,
you know, because of the failings of the Articles of Confederation, then... anything, everything, it became the supreme law of the land.
Right. Well,
everything was subject to it. Even though we were to adopt common law, where in common law was probably not in the realm of the Constitution. The Constitution ruled.
Right. So to be clear, those who point back to the Declaration of Independence completely gloss over and do not even include the Articles of Association. The Articles of Association is what created the Continental Congress, which is what created the Declaration of Independence.
I don't even think they know what that is.
I understand that. But the reality is that the states or the people of the states actually created a union called the Articles of Association, so that because they were going to form this body called Continental Congress,
right.
And in so doing, they had to basically agree on the powers that they were going to grant this body to govern them. And when you read the Articles of Confederation, it was very limited, but they did empower them to do the one thing that they needed to do, which was basically declare independence, mm-hmm. which basically then required, after the Declaration of Independence, that they needed to reconfigure into a true confederation, which is why they created the Articles of the Confederation. Of the perpetual union, right? And so when after they did that, and all three of these steps of the way, not that there wasn't the divine hand of providence inspiring them, they were not focused in holding hands with that divine hand of providence. In other words,
what do you mean?
Well, when we look at the Constitution for the United States, that was truly, you know, they went and sought and held the hand of God in trying to erect a government.
Okay.
The first three, the Articles of Association, the Declaration of Independence, and the Articles of Confederation, show me the records where there was that concerted effort. To hold the hand of our Creator in guiding us exactly what to do.
Well, look at the last paragraph of the Declaration of Independence.
Uh-huh.
Okay, where it says,
have it up probably before you do.
Here we go. Okay. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world, for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are of right ought to be free and independent states. Okay? So at least they recognize...
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that they didn't, but when... You know who wrote the Declaration? We basically know it was Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
But we know that it was Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams that mm-hmm. were appointed to be the subcommittee to present that declaration. Okay. When they went off into this subcommittee, let's just kind of play what Franklin and Adams said. Well, you know, you seem to have this, because I think Jefferson started running with this. I think the Lord prepared him well beforehand, because he already argued in 1770 that all men were created equal.
Right.
And so that line right there that he put into the Declaration of Independence, some people say it was George Mason that actually said that. No, he actually copied it from Thomas Jefferson when he was defending a mulatto's freedom to be, you know, for a mulatto to become free. And so...
Nobody knows that, G.R.
Well, if you've read my first book, they have. But, right? I mean, so you're right. There's a lot of people that don't report on all of these little nuances of our history. But here's the fact that Thomas Jefferson literally started flowing from him. And I believe that Adams and Franklin just recognized, and they just stood back and goes, go ahead. And he created that draft.
Right.
And they were so impressed, and because they were abolitionists, they had no problem whatsoever with the draft of what he created. It wasn't until it was presented to the body of the whole of Continental Congress at that time, where the Southern states said, "Nah, we do not want you talking about slavery that way."
Right. There's some words that aren't in the Declaration of Independence. That Thomas Jefferson originally put there. I wrote an article on that.
Right. The whole paragraph was removed. And so all that being said, more than a paragraph, several paragraphs. But all that being said, all I'm trying to really point out, and there's no evidence that says that, you know, when Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and, you know, John Adams convened into this subcommittee, that they broke in prayer and worked together.
Okay.
There was no point in time where, when we looked at the Articles of Association, that they struggled and they said, somebody came along and said, hey, let's go over here and pray so that we can work together.
Okay.
And that's the same thing with the Articles of Confederation. We actually have hard documentation that they not only, you know, struggled, that it was recommended by Franklin to actually go off to a church and pray that they can unite and work together. Mm-hmm. And this is the consistency of God, which is why he didn't bless the states because of the Puritans. He didn't bless the states because of the Anglicans or the Baptists or the Congressionalists or whatever faith. He blessed us as a people because we put aside our differences and our self-interest and worked together.
Okay. Ah. And there were differences.
And there were significant differences. Folks, the Puritans did not like the rest of the states. They created two states because they cast them out for apostasy. Connecticut and New Hampshire were formed because they were non-compliant to the purest standards, and these preachers and ministers were kicked out, went to those states, and those new states formed with those new religions that sprung from the Puritans.
Right.
And so, you know, they differed significantly over labor, slavery, or abolition. When we look at today, we find the pettiest things that we divide over.
Hang on a minute.
Go ahead.
You mean there were disagreeing abolitionists?
No. So what I'm saying is that during the Constitutional Convention, at that point in time, the states were divided over how they wanted to choose labor. There were the Southern states that clung to slavery, and many of the Northern states were clinging to abolition, getting rid of slavery, and going to a free market system. So, I mean, they were divided in many ways. I look at how they were divided. Those were key, important things that they were divided on. And I look at today, and it is these nuances and this person's, you know, a Catholic. This person's a Seventh-day Adventist, a Mormon. It doesn't matter.
Right.
To me, it's why are we trifling over these things when the Lord will clearly bless us if we unite and put aside our differences and our self-interests? Okay. And that's the other problem, folks, that there's so many people that are so appealed and making millions of dollars by basically talking about the problem. Mark Levin and Glenn Beck and the rest of these guys that are making millions of dollars have no vested interest in solving this problem. They're getting rich off it.
Why? You don't think they'd have something to talk about if the problem were solved?
I think that they realize that the relevance of people wanting to know what to do would go away. Once everybody found their cheese again, which is their liberty and their sovereignty, you know, how relevant is talk radio? You know, we could go back to actually doing and focused on local issues. This the one of the reasons why this is so sexy for all of these guys, Sean Hannity, the rest of these guys, is because it's on a national stage and it makes it easy for them. They've got this big bad guy that, you know, the federal government, the Democrats, what have you, and they get everybody sucked into, you know, how bad these guys are. And, you know, then they protect the orange guy. And, it, you know, it's literally us and them. They are making a living off of being divisive.
Right.
When what we have to do, and clearly the Lord's plan is very simple. All we have to do is unite on his constitution and put aside our differences as well as our self-interests. You walk in and you are open to supporting fully that constitution, you will find how much more aligned you are with us than you are with any other organization out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. It really is. But we're talking about amendments, and so we're moving. Okay. We're trying to move away from. And I just wanted to point out how the 10th Amendment and how we kind of solved all of this, and how we get sucked into these divisive, like the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. It goes back to that one of the Star Treks that is just embedded in my head, where these two brothers. Were, you know, one had black on one side of their face or body, and the other one had it on the other side. And they right. hated each other. They were trying to kill each other. And, you know, I mean, these guys looked identical. They were twins, if I remember correctly. It's
right.
just that,
it's just that
yes, the only difference was where the black was.
Right.
And so the whole point of that message was, we're so petty that we will make up ways to divide ourselves.
Uh-huh. Star Trek was kind of pioneering in that type.
It was. It really was. And, you know, there was a lot of evil undertones, like this collectivism and that type of stuff.
Right.
But and it became more and more of the leader and teacher of evolution. And, yeah. you know, turning its back on God. There was that. But you didn't necessarily get that in the very first, you know, season. Or I should say the first series. The second series, yeah. it became very evident that it was all about evolution and godless. Picard and company. Anyway, so I digress. Now we're going to deal with the 11th Amendment. And we kind of touched this already when we hit the Article 3. So, Paul, if you would, go ahead.
Okay. Amendment
11. And now this was proposed in 1794, right? I mean, when were the Bill of Rights ratified? Let me just go up to the Bill of Rights, the top here.
1791, I think.
Well, actually, right. they were ratified in 1792.
Okay.
Oh, hold it. Not 1792, 1791. It was 1992 where the 27th Amendment was ratified.
Right. right. Okay. So we are now reading Article 11.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state.
Okay, so what this basically was, and we covered this in detail, right? How many states actually complained that the federal jurisdiction would extend to this?
I think all of them.
Oh, yeah, the ones that actually contested it, they all pointed to this as being a problem. So are we surprised that this amendment came up and said, hey, we're getting rid of this?
No, and it came up quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, 1794, after the Bill of Rights, only 3 years later, and it took 4 years to ratify, and maybe it took 4 years to ratify because it had there were more states in the Union at this point in time, and maybe they needed to be brought into why that was so important. You know, you got to remember that the new kid doesn't have the experience. They didn't go through, they didn't cut their teeth in ratifying the Constitution, so there may have been some... A little bit of learning or what have you, but, you know, nevertheless, it did get ratified. And they pulled back that authority of the federal court to not extend to these very specific types of cases.
And there's another thing that I think we forget, or it has been forgotten, is that the Congress, or the people through their amendments, have the authority to limit the jurisdiction of the federal court.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And, well, just remember that the jurisdiction is limited to only those things arising under this Constitution.
Correct.
In other words, even treaties. The treaties must be in compliance to the Constitution. In other words, they just can't make a treaty. That treaty has to be within their authority. So it, too, the treaties must actually stem from the enumerated powers. No treaty can grant the federal government new power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So this next amendment I've inserted, this is not... You know, I've made several changes to this document since I copied it from John Rowland, because it's the U.S. Constitution. There's no intellectual property other than how we started marking it for violations. So this next amendment I actually inserted that he didn't include.
Draft on an amendment?
Yes, this is correct. Draft? This is the unproposed by Congress and unratified. So in other words, Congress never proposed this. And so it was never sent out, and it was never ratified. And it was an amendment proposed by the sitting president, Thomas Jefferson, but not proposed by Congress in response to the Louisiana Purchase.
Okay. So this is three paragraphs. I'll read it, and then we'd like to know what was on Jefferson's mind.
So actually, we've got just a minute. So go ahead and try reading the first paragraph, and we'll see where we are with that.
Okay. The province of Louisiana is incorporated with the United States and made part thereof. The rights of occupancy in the soil and of self-government are confirmed to the Indian inhabitants as they now exist. Preemption only of the portions rightfully occupied by them and a succession to the occupancy of such as they may abandon, with the full rights of possession as well as of property and sovereignty in whatever is not or shall cease to be so rightfully occupied by them, shall belong to the United States, or the U.S. is what he says. Okay.
All right.
That's the first paragraph.
That's the first paragraph. And so one of the key things here is that this is the first time the Constitution's ever used this word soil.
Okay.
The rights of the occupancy in the soil. And so this is the opening of the door of mineral rights, my friends. Because at this point in time, they started realizing, because Indiana was just around the corner, and they started realizing that there were some very important minerals like salt mines and so forth that were out there that they needed to kind of protect for the national interest. So folks, as we said, we're going to be going into a break. So when we come back, we'll start off with the discussion regarding mineral rights, and then also this concept of what he is proposing in this first paragraph. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back, Paul. And so we were just talking about the very first paragraph of Jefferson's right. amendment. Now, this is a proposed amendment. This wasn't a hardcore amendment. And so he presents this idea, the rights of occupancy in the soil and of the self-government. So one of the things we find in the state of Indiana, the territory at this point in time called Indiana, because Indiana had already become a territory and was on its way. I think it became a state in the Union. You know what? I actually have this available to me. So as I fumble over here and I look for statehood order, I can find Indiana became a state in 1816.
Okay.
So I'm here to tell you that, you know, a state doesn't form in 13 years. It, you know, people have already migrated out there. They've already got a provisional territorial government. They've at this point in time, the Congress has sent out dispatches of the militia on duty to go out and patrol the area and make it safe for the inhabitants. And at this point in time, they've discovered salt mines out there and able to harvest the salt, which is why in their Enabling Act that we could get into later, I don't think I'm going to have the time this year to go into the Enabling Acts. Maybe we'll do that early next year. But in the Indiana Enabling Act, the federal government kind of they put their toe on the line and say, you have like these 12 salt mines that we mm-hmm. consider a national resource that we recommend you do not sell. Okay. They didn't forbid them to sell it. What they did was they recommended they don't sell it. And what they do is they lease it so that, you know, if there's a chemical company or a mining company that goes in there, that they will lease that land and that the state will still always have the authority. So in other words, this was the beginning concept of mineral rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started over salt, not gold.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, why is salt so important?
Well, salt, you know, if I understand correctly, at one point I believe I think we've all heard, that they paid Roman soldiers in salt. All right? Salt just has universal uses.
Right.
And so it's considered valuable, but I had a question. It'll come back to me. It just escaped.
Oh, right okay. Now. So, and you bring up a really good point because, you know, this is something that has been such a big part of our lives. It's always on our table. How many people, folks, do you have enough of a supply of salt? Why is salt important? Because it preserves food. So mm-hmm. when you start looking at salt and its role, come on, you know, if all of a sudden you have to do without and you don't have refrigeration or anything else, what are you going to use for preservation?
You'll use salt. In fact, we didn't have refrigerators. You know what? They didn't have refrigerators back then.
That's right.
Salt was a valuable preservative.
That's right. That's why liquor, wine, brew, it was all very valuable because that's how they sustained themselves when they couldn't, you know, they didn't have, you know, strawberries available in their grocery store every day of the year.
Right.
Because of a global economy, we have the beauty and the luxury of doing that. That's the blessing that has come from living under this Constitution. And we're getting closer and closer. We're actually seeing the scarcity of items because of, you know, the overreach of government.
Sure.
And it's only going to get worse as we get more and more divided. And we're
I don't know. I don't know that people really have any concept of what it's like to go into a store and see empty grocery shelves.
Correct.
I really don't. I remember when I was younger, we had a blizzard in the Midwest. I was in central Columbus, Ohio. We had a blizzard. The blizzard was 77, 78. It, in an hour and a half, we got 6 inches of snow, and that was just an hour and a half, and it didn't stop snowing till the next day. It shut down the Midwest, especially parts of Ohio. And when a few days later, when the snow started to clear, I happened to go to the grocery store, and it is a freaky sight to see bare shelves.
Right. So your grocery store folks, it's the same thing with Costco. Even though you see all those supplies, I mean, there's not enough room for you to have those in your house. When you see a store, that's only a fraction of what gets consumed by the homes in the community that these stores support. They can't have 100% of what you need for the whole year, nor can they have 100% of what you need for a month. They basically are supplying you, you know, your toy. I think we started learning, at least this should have been one of the lessons that we learned from the pandemic. But back to this whole amendment, right?
Sure.
So right. Thomas Jefferson basically introduced this concept of the right in soil and of self-government are confirmed to the inhabitants of the Indians in that area that now exist. Preemption only of the ports. So they only have the inhabiting area of what they currently consider they possess. Now,
right.
To be clear, folks, the real problem with what he was saying is that the Indians never really staked out their property. They just thought that the property belonged to, you know, everything.
It was like the air.
Right. That the animals, all things, shared the air. they were a very backward society. They were very primitive in many ways. But they had some civility. And as a matter of fact, I don't think you knew this, but I do mention this in my first book, that there were some very interesting commonalities between the American Indians and the Native Americans and the people of Israel, that J.M. Roberts in the World's History, it's a comprehensive history going all the way back from creation. J.M. Roberts is an evolutionist, and he wasn't trying to connect any dots, but he made a comment that there were several tribes in the North American Native Americans that actually claimed to be, not knowing that they claimed to be a part of that chosen people of God. They use very similar terms.
I am familiar with that, and I've heard very similar, not just that, I've heard, and this is straying, I know we'll get back to the point, but I've even heard archaeological evidence.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
This kind of thing. So.
Right. So
I just thought it was interesting.
So what he's basically doing is he's basically saying the stuff, you know, the land that they kind of, you know, have, they're going to keep out of this Louisiana territory, right? Okay.
Right.
So the next paragraph, what does this talk about? Now go ahead.
Okay. next paragraph. The legislature of the Union shall have authority to exchange the right of occupancy in portions where the U.S. have full right for lands possessed by Indians within the U.S. on the east side of the Mississippi to exchange lands on the east side of the river for those on the west side thereof and above the latitude of 31 degrees to maintain in any part of the province such military posts as may be requisite for peace or safety, to exercise police over all persons therein, not being Indian inhabitants, to work salt springs or mines of coal, metals, and other minerals within the possession of the U.S. or in any others with the consent of the possessors, to regulate trade and intercourse between the Indian inhabitants and all other persons, to explore and ascertain the geography of the province, its productions and other interesting circumstances, to open roads and navigation therein where necessary for beneficial communication and to establish agencies and factories therein for the cultivation of commerce, peace, and good understanding with the Indians residing there.
Okay, so do you see the whole mess of what he's creating here? Do you see what he's actually granting Congress in this really ambiguous portion of this amendment? So, because he starts off with the legislature of the Union shall have the authority to exchange the rights of the land for those on the east side to the west and likewise, and that they will have policing authority out there for the security. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to also have the, you know, because it says to exercise police over all persons therein. And then they're also, it's basically,
that are not, by the way, that are not Indians, right?
Correct. And then he also says, so he's creating a national police force.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have one. They don't have the ability to do this. And then he also says that we're also going to control, the federal government will now control the work at salt mines, or the salt springs, or mines of coal, metals, and other minerals.
Okay.
So, like I told you, he in the first paragraph, he kind of introduces, hey, we're going to start taking control over minerals. It's not enumerated mm-hmm. in the Constitution, and he's suggesting that it actually gets enumerated. And he also goes as far as to actually start talking about, you know, the Indian inhabitants of where they're going to stay, regulate them, and not only regulate them, but regulate the commerce as well as the roads, to open roads and navigation. Basically, granting the federal government through this amendment, the Department of Transportation.
Okay.
You see the power that he's looking to give the federal government.
So Jefferson understood that if there was anything, that if you wanted to grant the government any extra authority, you needed to make an amendment.
Yes, he did understand that. Yes.
Okay. But here's to be as nearly libertarian, and I'm using that term loosely, as Jefferson was, what was on his mind as he was promoting this idea?
Well, he realized that they now had all of this land, and he wanted to solve some problems, because was he not the first president to entertain the chiefs of America? Was he not the first president to actually document the language of 20-some-odd tribes? I mean, so he actually became very intimate with the Native Americans, or these tribes. It was his desire to integrate them, but he realized that some of them did not want to be integrated. And he felt that, okay, if you don't want to be integrated, then we need to find some land for you to permanently give you and create a state.
Okay.
And so what does he say there? What area of that land is that?
It looked like, well, if he says within the U.S. on the east side of the Mississippi, right?
Right. But there's actually what we call the 31st parallel.
Where is that?
Ah.
Hang on a minute.
Uh-huh.
31st parallel. I'm looking it up.
Okay.
I meant to do that. parallel.
Uh-huh.
Hang on a minute. I did a typo here. 31st parallel. Okay. Where is the 31st parallel? It is 31 degrees north. Okay, but where is it?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay, so the 31st parallel, and to be honest with
wow.
you.
Wow. Go ahead.
It's very far south.
Yes.
And so the 31st parallel basically encompasses, I would say, from the southern border of Arizona and New Mexico north.
Yeah, west side thereof and above the latitude of 31 degrees. That's a lot.
Uh-huh. Right. So here's a good, I've got a pretty decent map of this. And so the 32nd degree is just north of the Arizona and the New Mexico tip, the 32nd degree. The 31st degree gets really, really close to it, just really close. So like I said, if you go along that 31st degree, he's basically saying north of the Mississippi, all of that land that would encompass Texas, Oklahoma, even, because it's the Mississippi, right? So that would encompass Arkansas, Louisiana, the north part of Louisiana. It would encompass right. Iowa. It would encompass everything west of that.
Right.
Right.
It would encompass Missouri.
Right. And, you know, okay. A lot of times the good intentions sometimes would really lead to real mischief. And so Thomas Jefferson was really basically, because he didn't see the need for the American people to actually have or possess that land west. And what he wanted to do was empower Congress to grant that land to the Indians. Why? Because in the Constitution, they do not have that authority.
Sure. That's why he proposed an amendment.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
Nor do they have the authority to grant and delegate land anywhere in the Constitution to basically create a reservation and regulate them.
Mm.
Where in the Constitution does the federal government have the ability to go into a state and say, we're creating an Indian reservation and we will regulate them and this will be federal property?
They don't.
Okay, thank you.
They don't have that.
They don't have that authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so this amendment would have actually given, that would have opened the door for that and a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, folks, you're hearing this right here on the Radical Reclaiming the Republic. When you're hearing the truth about the Constitution, every single Indian reservation out there is absolutely a violation. The federal government was using authority that was never delegated to them. And then after the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment actually solved the problem, because every Indian that was, or a Native American that resided on a reservation was under the jurisdiction of the United States. So they were a citizen, just like the slaves.
That is, you know, when we get into it, Jerry,
we'll get into it on the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, that's an interesting debate about how they looked at Indians and whether or not we should make them citizens.
And they actually talked very specifically about whether, you know, is that our intent here? Whether we're going to make citizens out of this? That's actually in the debates, and I know you've covered this. So anyway, okay, so moving on. Now we've got this last little paragraph. Folks, we're only presenting to you an amendment that could have been, and the reason why it's important is because the powers that Thomas Jefferson was seeking were not included in the Constitution. This is why it needed to be amended. But go ahead. What's the third paragraph? Paul,
Okay.
Go ahead.
The legislature shall have no authority to dispose of the lands of the province otherwise than is herein before permitted until a new amendment of the Constitution shall give that authority, except as to that portion thereof which lies south of the latitude of 31 degrees, which whenever they deem expedient, they may erect into a territorial government, either separate or as making part with one on the eastern side of the river, vesting the inhabitants thereof with all the rights possessed by other territorial citizens of the U.S.
Okay, so basically he's granting them, you know, this authority, and he's basically saying that we're going to need to do another amendment on top of that, right?
Right.
Okay. And so Congress received this, and they kind of passed it around. I honestly think that they may have snickered, but I'm telling you that the big government that existed in D.C. at that point, you got to remember that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison kicked a lot of the big government Federalists out, but they were still enough big government and nationalists to say, no, we're not going to do this.
Okay.
Right. I think that there was still the mentality, and you got to remember when Jefferson finally left office in 1808, he had accomplished quite a bit in working with the Indian tribes. But okay. When he started working with the Indian tribes in 1803, and mm-hmm. actually prior to that, you know, with after the Louisiana Territory, that's why this amendment came forward. He goes, you know what, we have a real problem here. We've all of a sudden got this land that I acquired, and I would like to actually give it to these great people, the Native Americans, for those who don't want to integrate into the United States.
Right.
Okay. All right. So we got that done, and now we've got 6 minutes. So let's start with the 12th Amendment. Go ahead. Okay. And this was proposed by Congress to the states, designed by Congress for in 1803 regarding the choosing of the president. Go ahead.
Okay, this is a long one, but I think we can get through it. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom, at least, shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president and in distinct ballots the person voted for as vice president. And they shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president and of all persons voted for as a vice president, and of the number of votes for each which lists they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall be then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if no person has such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding 3 on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately, by ballot, the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having 1 vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states, and a majority of all states shall be necessary to a choice. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president, whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them before the 4th day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as president, as in the case of the death or other constitutional disability of the president. The person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be vice president. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if no person have a majority, then from the 2 highest members on the list, the Senate shall choose the vice president. A quorum for the purpose shall consist of 2/3 of the whole number of senators, and a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice, but no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of Vice President of the United States.
Okay, so Kamala Harris has no right to be, based on the 12th Amendment, she cannot be the Vice President.
Correct.
Okay, so we're in such a constitutional crisis because if you read this amendment, folks, you'll realize that we did not abide by this in any way, fashion, or form. We have devolved and we've adopted a process that absolutely subverts the whole concept of the Electoral College and the constitutional process of choosing a president. All of that being said, what is some of the most significant changes between this amendment and what was to be done under the Article 2 Electoral College guidance, Article 2, Section 1?
I think probably the most significant is the separate votes for president and vice president.
Yes, correct. When they actually had to choose who was going to be president and who would be vice president. So, folks, when it right here, the Constitution dictates that the electors are to determine who they are, not the parties.
And the big problem we have is that the parties have baked their party structure into state government.
Without a constitutional amendment to do that.
Right. Right. Well, they put it in their state constitutions, probably, but it's not in the federal constitution. And therefore, there isn't anything in the federal constitution that requires.
Yeah, so to be honest with you, there's right. no state constitution that can override this.
You're
I mean,
okay.
if they did, if they actually have it in their state constitution, it actually violates the U.S. Constitution because the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
All
but
right.
what happens is that you have a party structure that's baked into state election code.
Yes.
And what it does is that it down selects or out selects candidates from the people. Okay. By the way, by these private organizations, I was having this discussion with someone just over this weekend that these private organizations, let's say, have primaries, which means they make the taxpayers pay to choose who's going to come out of their private organizations when they should simply make that. If they're going to have a down selection, they should pay for it themselves. Right?
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the parties have basically co-opted this and the parties have gotten, because technically they have taken control of our legislative bodies. You can't tell me that the Republicans today, the reason why Congress is going, you know, in a circle sideways down a hill is because the Republicans can't pick a speaker.
Sure.
So, folks, does the Constitution allow the parties to determine and hold those types of controls?
No. No. In fact, the very fact that we're having this problem highlights the violations of the Constitution.
Correct. And because they've divided themselves to say, well, we want to control, so we're out of time. So we're going to have to pick this back up. We will pick back up the 12th Amendment in our next discussion, which actually is going to be next week. So on Monday, we will revisit the 12th Amendment and kind of go through the rest of how this, you know, how we're violating the 12th Amendment in the choosing of the president. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.